Color and Cannabis Podcast. We're very excited today to have Dr. Natasha Kalouf here with us today. And we're very excited to hear about her story. I've been a big fan of you for many years, Agricola Farms and the products that you've created, and love to hear about your story. So what do you do now?
Thank you, Taryn, for having me. I still run Agricola Flower. It used to be nursery as well, and I do some nursery production, but it's not so much cannabis anymore, though my flower is cannabis, along with other flowers. And then I also have a practice in Sonoma County where I have an integrative medical clinic.
Nice. So you want to give us a little bit of your background, your story, how you got here?
Well, I got to cannabis via... just growing up, and I grew up in the San Fernando Valley down in Southern California and in the 90s. And there was a lot of interesting activity going on around me. And I was fortunate enough to come across cannabis, and it really opened up a colorful world of art and music and culture for me that I've really just held on to for all this time.
Did you get into cannabis before your medical practice, or is it one to come before the other? Or which came before the other? And can you describe a little bit more about your work in medicine?
Okay, so I actually was raised with a pretty holistic upbringing, or I should say traditional. I don't think my parents would use integrative or holistic. I've actually never heard them use either of those words. But I was raised with a traditional Nicaraguan diet and Lebanese diet. And so a lot of that was the foundation for me understanding how to approach health and wellness. And as a teenager, when I started partaking in cannabis, it just brought me into a lot of different circles that I think I otherwise wouldn't have been exposed to. And I actually happened to be at a party a gentleman who would later become my mentor passed me a joint, and he had a conversation opener that just like hit me over the head. And then we instantly started talking, and he was about 40 years older than me, and we just became friends, and he was my first mentor in Chinese medicine. And I think I was about 15 or 16 at the time.
Okay, interesting. So you kind of got involved in Chinese medicine before you got into growing or cannabis in that scale.
Yeah, I was already a bit of a cannabis snob at 15, believe it or not, because where I grew up, a certain type of cannabis was really popular, and I sought out some other cannabis that wasn't in my immediate social circles. And so that made it to where at that point I had a pretty good understanding of what in terms of what was in the landscape in terms of cannabis.
So how old were you when you first started smoking? Was that at 15 or did you start before that?
I started before that. I have three older siblings, and you know, the San Fernando Valley in the 90s was gang culture was rampant, and so that was part of the landscape in which I grew up. And so the cannabis that was mostly surrounding me was what was referred to as, you know, swag, Mexican swag or brick weed. And I got a taste of that, and I'm like, it's got to be a little bit some more finer delicacies for my palate. And so that had me branch out, which brought me to basically, you know, the white boys who had better herb at the time.
And so back then when you first started consuming, did you know that you wanted to get into production for yourself, or is it just recreational? You're just enjoying consuming it?
I was enjoying consuming it, and I was enjoying the culture and the communities that were brought together by it. Because at this point, 15 into 16, I had actually tested out of high school, and I started going to Los Angeles Valley Community College. And so I started actually being exposed to different communities. I was always a big hip-hop fan, and the underground music scene and breakdancing scene was really big at the time. And I had a lot of friends that were going to California State, Northridge, and it was just a really amazing time in the Valley, in LA, in the 90s.
Excellent. So how did your parents approach you using cannabis? Were they strict in general? Because both one's Nicaraguan and the other one's Lebanese. So how was it, what was their reaction to you ingesting cannabis?
So my dad, like, didn't really, my mom was the authority figure in my household, and she was really against it. But I've always been the quintessential black sheep, so I just kind of, like, dealt with it. At the same time, I was always academically gifted, and so she kind of couldn't really say much, because I would not make it to all my classes, and that was my biggest issue in high school, but I would show up and ace the test. So it's kind of hard to reprimand a kid that actually knew the answers to the test.
If you're getting straight A's, you're getting straight A's.
Well, they had an automatic fail policy if you're absent 20 or more. So I actually wasn't getting straight A's, but I figured the loop, which was the hack, which was to test out of high school. And I, at 15, I took the California high school proficiency exam. It might have been right before I turned 16, but right around there. And I tested out of high school and began college.
Okay, so how did the path go from just consuming cannabis to growing it and producing it yourself? Was it down there in SoCal? What were the steps you took?
So I had a couple shots at growing some plants in my friend's backyard. I grew up mostly in apartment buildings, but I did have a couple friends growing up that had backyards. So we would try to do that, and that didn't quite work out. We'd always get caught right before harvest. And so when I was 18, I moved up to Santa Cruz, and I didn't know it yet, but that opened up a whole new world to me. And I met a grower who later would become a partner and the father of my kids. And he was a grower. He was a really, really skilled indoor grower, and it just opened up a whole other reality that was unbeknownst to me at the time.
So did you move up there, did you move to Santa Cruz for cannabis, or you just moved up there, and then once you got up there, you met him, and you kind of got into the business that way?
I moved to Santa Cruz to pursue my path in Chinese medicine. So I went to a school out there, and I began to do like my pre-med. I was also simultaneously studying dance. When I lived in LA, I was studying contemporary forms of dance. And then when I moved up to Santa Cruz, I was really blessed to be exposed to some different styles that just really just broadened my horizon and nurtured me in more ways than one. So when I met a grower, it just was like a natural sequence of events, being that I was studying traditional herbal medicine.
Excellent, excellent. And so how long did you stay in Santa Cruz working down there in the industry?
I stayed in Santa Cruz until I basically had a walkthrough by the sheriffs at my home. And my daughter was about 9 months old, and they came to our house, and that was, I had some residual PTSD growing up in LA from just dealing with cops. And so when they came into my home, when I had literally a 9-month-old on my hip, and they searched my home and went, I literally had to like set down my baby so they could search me in my own home and like patted her down. It was enough of a prompt to move. And so I had some friends further up north that encouraged us to come up with the promise of safety, and we made the move.
Excellent, excellent. And so did you start Agricola flower up here, or was it still in Santa Cruz when you first started?
It was up here. So I left Santa Cruz in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so I moved up to Sonoma County and started cultivating out there in the hillsides, indoors still. We would do some outdoors, but mostly we were growing indoors. And at this point, we had quite a few Prop 215 recommendations on file, and we were working. I was still working in LA because I had a lot of connections and folks that I had grown up with that were now in the industry and having dispensaries and retail outlets that were really beneficial to us at the time.
That's a serious commute.
Yeah. I mean, I did it about a few times a year, and I always visited family. My folks were still living down there and all my siblings. And so I got in my family visits at the same time.
Nice. So how did your family relate to you actually getting formally in the cannabis industry beyond just using it, but now you're producing it. Now you're an actual business owner in cannabis.
So at the time, you know, if you recall prior to, let's say, like 2017, 2016, like we weren't actually treated like we were business owners. It was like this in the closet thing that we did, but the legitimacy was still far from being achieved. And so I was in school, and that was sort of like my forward face to the public. And even though my family knew what I did, it was kind of like you just didn't talk that much about it. Mm-hmm. But simultaneously, something was evolving, which was my mom would come up during my trim sessions, and she would help manage my scenes. And so even though her initial response to it when I was a kid and young adult was, you know, pretty negative because she just feared the consequences, as she saw that it was actually a means to supporting myself and my family, she kind of got in line and became, you know, a really important supporting ally for me.
Absolutely. And what was your dad's thoughts about it? It sounded like he was already kind of more relaxed about things in general, so.
Well, my dad culturally comes from one of the oldest cannabis regions of the world. Mm-hmm. You know, the Bekaa Valley is, you know, my uncle Musa lives out there still. And so culturally, he didn't have the same taboos and that my mom had. And even though they're both, you know, Christian Catholic raised, or I should say they're both Catholic raised, my father now identifies as being a Christian, my dad didn't have the influence of like the church telling him that it was such a bad thing and all drugs and are evil. It was, I don't know how they approached it in Lebanon, but I could just tell he was just cool with it. And I remember one time when I was a kid, he actually asked me to get him some hash. And I was like, hash? I was like, who has the hash? Because like I said, I was still navigating, like finding the good herb. And so, like, you know, I remember it became like this, like, you know, whole big journey to find the good hash, which was really beautiful when I met, you know, Frenchie, because he's like, oh, you're Lebanese? I'm like, yeah, I'm Lebanese. And he knew all about it. So I was like, yeah. So, you know, it was great when I got to bring my pops some hash from Frenchie. And yeah.
That's really cool. I think so many of us just presume that so many cultures are people who actually come from another country, they're immigrants, that they're a little bit stricter about things. And I think we take for granted that the fact that there is a cannabis tradition in many other countries. So when people are coming in from these countries, they don't automatically have the same prejudices we do because they have their own cultural background to it. So did anyone in your family ever produce cannabis, like in Lebanon or anything? Is that part of your family line over there? Or do they respond to that when you tell them what you're doing now? Do they respond to it as if this is something that is continuing on part of their cultural tradition?
Yeah, so I think, to answer one of your first questions, no one in my immediate family in like the last, I'd say, 75 years has been, like in Lebanon, has been producing cannabis. Further back, I'm not aware of. I have to dig a little deeper. I mean, some these things still, it's not like even in Lebanon, I mean, there's a lot of political tensions around these things, and they're commodities that present challenges still. So even though they are part of the culture, it's not with a lot of, you know, there's still tension around being producers. So I think a lot of it is still kept on the down low, and people aren't like blatantly advertising or even sharing with one another, even within families, you know, what they're necessarily doing. A lot of like what a lot of my life's work been, you know, my mom and my pops don't really know the extent of everything I've been involved with in cannabis in the last, you know, 20 or so years.
Makes sense. What about, again, like, I guess on your mom's side, what about your extended family there? And I ask that because for a lot of people, our parents can accept what we're doing, but like our grandparents might have a different view of it, or the extended family that aren't actually physically close to us. So how does your Nicaraguan side of the family know what you do, and do they have a thought about it? Do they have a feeling one way or the other about what you're doing?
So now the climate's completely changed, and I actually have, I have two of my siblings, there's five of us total, two of my siblings are in the cannabis industry, and then I have some cousins and other extended family that are also in the industry, but I think it's just because it's become, they see that it's the legitimacy, they see billboards, they see everything like that. But I think for a long time, my mom was like, oh, don't tell it was a big hush-hush thing for a long time. Now, my abuela lived till she was 99 and a half years old, and I remember, you know, she did make the trek up north, and I remember, like, I could tell she just didn't care, and it was almost like I think the value of a going against the grain is really appreciated by our grandparents. I think our parents were more encouraged to keep in line, but I think our grandparents really had to encourage and cherish the opportunities to go against the grain despite the challenges and the adversity that they almost always inevitably brought.
Yeah, that's definitely my experience as well. I was shocked to see that my grandparents were a little bit more progressive about certain things than my parents, because they appreciated the like entrepreneurial spirit and just trying to do something different and trying to make something of yourself kind of a vibe. So I was shocked about that well with our family.
Yeah, my mom really, I could see the pressure to assimilate a lot more than in my abuela or even in my father, for whatever reason. I think it's always hard when you're coming from a different place and coming to a place that's supposed to be the advancement of all the world, and you feel this insane amount of pressure to acclimate and to adopt the values of that particular country.
Absolutely. What impact do you feel that your cultural background, either being Lebanese or Nicaraguan, has had on you in business, or how you've approached building your business or building your community around yourself? Do you feel like those have impacted your decisions, like your cultural background, things you learned from your parents or your family?
Absolutely. I mean, I have always been, there's an untold story that I don't feel is mine to necessarily tell, though I have a part in its telling, which is the Latino folks that have been growing the majority of the cannabis in the hills of Northern California. We often see the white forward faces of the men who bring these brands and who get to bask in the bounty and the abundance. But within that is where we... the labor, and we can say in every regard in California, whether we're looking at almonds or broccoli or, you know, carpentry, that the labor is coming from the Latino folks. And that's not a mystery, and that's not, you know, a surprise. However, there's still a huge, huge, huge gap in being able to truly account for those folks. And because there's an issue with, you know, having documentation and proper pay and respect and value in our society, this is a really the darkest part of our shadow industry. And so how this has been a really key piece for me is that as a Spanish speaker, I've been always able to speak to my fellow farmers and advocate for them and provide resources that they otherwise wouldn't have access to, things such as genetics or IPM, integrative pest management, outlets and just general support that a lot of times when we talk about barriers to entry, a lot of us fail to really acknowledge the impact that lack of education or resources has on folks. So I will always have a part of me in that world and be advocating for my people in that way. And so it's my, you know, mom's blood in me that has made me really about that. You know, my mom is still a really big advocate for, you know, so she lives up north now and she still has her crews of folks that she helps and advocates for and connects with job placement and make sure that they're being taken care of and make sure that they get paid. And that's a really big thing because so many folks, you know, will work a season, they'll grow someone's entire crop, they'll get kicked off a farm, they'll get beaten, they'll get threatened with the cops, and they're literally the grower, but they don't own the land, and they don't own the resources, and they don't have papers. So they literally experience these instances within their family and within their communities. So having allies such as myself and my mom are just, you know, really invaluable. As it relates to my father, you know, Lebanese people. So my father is 100% Lebanese. And I say that because, you know, most countries have been infiltrated in one way or the other. And most of us are a combination of lots of things. But my father is 100%. And so I feel his blood really strong in me. And one thing that they have been good at, you know, for a really long time is trade. And, you know, the infamous Silk Road. And so I feel that my experience in cannabis and being able to network and engage with my community and trade and be somewhat a sensible business person has a lot to do with my Lebanese side and knowing the value in relationships.
Interesting. What, and so how did you feel like you've been treated up north due to, I mean, you're a woman on your own business, you're farming up there, and you also come from these diverse backgrounds. How has the reception been for you in your community that you live in now? Both from the people and then from a policy point of view, dealing with the local government and all that?
Well, on one hand, I think that being a woman affords me a certain amount of approachability, and I appreciate that because I do think I because of my education and some other factors that they're, you know, working with the ways in which I intimidate people is always an interesting thing. So
you are kind of intimidating, I think, a lot.
So I appreciate that I'm a woman because I do feel that, like, I'm a little bit more approachable. At the same time, I have these other things that make it to where, like, you know, they might negate that. In terms of being respected in this industry, I've had to get really good at being really good and being okay with essentially not getting credit most of the time for being good. And so I'm one out of five kids. I was usually the kid that got blamed and never got acknowledged. So I'm like, it's like...
It's normal.
I'm like, you know what? No big deal. Like, you know, but you know what? I'm like an incredible cook in my family, and I've worked my way into my mom's heart through my cooking. And so, like, I've also seen the value of just, like, really sticking your head down and, like, getting to your work and just having respect and love for your craft. And I think we're in a time in history and society where, like, someone, you know, it's like a little kid, you know, when a little kid, like, you know, like, puts on its shoe for the first time, and it's like, look, Mom, I did this. And you're like, okay, come on, let's go. And it's like, it's something so basic, but they want applaud and they want recognition. And so all day long, we're seeing this in the internet, you know, people do real basic things and they want all kinds of recognition. And these young people, you know, these teenagers and all that really need that right now. And so I've learned to just, like, or I wouldn't say learned, I've conditioned myself to be my number one, I won't say fan, because I'm actually like my biggest critic, but I just like knowing at the end of the day that my opinion is what matters most. And if I'm pleased with my work and my ability to get a job done, like, that's the greatest satisfaction to me. And I've conditioned myself to not actually need outward applause. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's really rare. And at times it's, some can perceive that as harmful, because now are you anyone if you don't have X amount of followers? Mm-hmm. And, I still really value the intimacy of one's work. And when I'm on my farm and it's just me, like, that's a really holy place for me, and a time and a space. And it's always an interesting dynamic when I have quite a bit of friends that are Instagram famous, and whenever they're around me, I think they're like, you know, they want to glean all this content off me. And I'm just like, and you know, they usually come and they stay for a few days, and you know, they'll have their cameras and phones on, and I'm just like, and I slowly begin to feel like the sacredness of like my experience is being like invaded. And not to say that there's not a value for like documentation or filming or recording, I mean, hence this like beautiful podcast that, you know, you're doing, but I think that there's also something to be said of the overexploitation of like a sacred moment and like what we get out of it. So
absolutely.
I forgot what that question
was. No, that was good. That was a good answer. We'll stick with that 100%. What are some of the policy hurdles that you're dealing with now?
Okay, so I became unknowingly and not trying to, I became one of the first people permitted in Sonoma County. I'm the only woman, and there's not a whole lot of diversity in that as well.
The first permit or first equity permit or just first permit
first
at all?
First permit, first wow. Cultivation permit. Amazing. I actually was the second, but the first is no longer. So I'm now the longest running cultivation permit in Sonoma County.
Excellent. And congratulations.
Thank you. And so about 2 years into having a permit, the county itself changed its rules. They changed it from a 5-acre minimum to a 10-acre minimum. And I was caught in that. And they promised me that they would, quote unquote, grandfather me in, and they would create a pipeline revision to where, despite me not meeting that requirement because I had got in previous to them changing the rules, that they would honor me. That caused me to have to, when I went in for a renewal, I had to reapply entirely, and that was in 2020 after having a permit for 2018 and 2019. And so I reapplied through the building department, building department, when previously I was dealing with the agricultural department. And then lo and behold, COVID hit in March. And so my application and my processing got queued up, even though I was allowed to be in operation. And for the last 3 years, I've been in queue, and now I'm officially up for my public hearing. So I, you know, been licensed and permitted 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, 22, 23. And now I'm up for this public hearing where they're telling me they're formally going to recommend my denial. So I have, obviously a vested land rights interest in my land, being that I've been cultivating there for 6 years and have developed it for cultivation. And so in Sonoma County, they have been guilty of doing a lot of really questionable things. And I know a lot of folks that are challenging and creating and setting precedents and in their own individual way. My particular situation is such that I was given permission, they changed their mind, and now they're trying to take it away. So and that is really prompted by, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention that has to do with my local community. I'm in an area where most of the available and eligible parcels of land for cultivation wound up. And that's where I found this piece of property and got my permit. But it also happens to be the most conservative area with very, very little diversity. So when I came up there before I stuck a shovel in the ground, they saw that I was a woman. They looked at my name and they pretty much started a slur campaign against me, talking about the crime that I was going to bring in, the property value I was going to decrease, the smell that was going to make them sick, and the guns and their safety and all that. And that was literally, like I said, before I even stuck a shovel in their ground, they were organizing town hall meetings against me. They did not include me. I went anyway. I sat without being known, without any of them knowing it was me. I listened to their concerns. I tried to respond by having my own town hall meetings to educate the community. And now I've been there for 6 years. So they see that I haven't increased the crime. They see that I haven't decreased the property value. They see that the smell is not really the nuisance they thought it was. And simultaneously, I will say, I cultivate on a quarter of an acre, and my property is about 5.5 acres. So that's like a fraction of my property, which was all non-native grasses. There wasn't a tree on my property to begin with. Across the street, it's about 300 acres of grapes have gone in. So there's an entire vineyard on the hillside that was this beautiful rolling hill pastures. And I know that vineyard in the installation of it, which has happened in the last few years, has gotten a fraction of the pushback that my legal cannabis farm has gotten. And why that's really interesting and the role I play in Sonoma County and part of my history, which you asked me about earlier, is from day one, I've always been a really big advocate for people having access to clean medicine. And as I evolved as a grower, I began to see and that a lot of folks were cultivating without a conscience, and they were using things that would render this plant in its final product not really good medicine. And so I prided myself on being able to bring really clean quality medicine to my collection of Proposition 215 patients and the dispensaries that were working with those patients as well. And so when I got my doctorates and became a licensed primary care physician, I was really committed to still educating other healthcare practitioners and advocating for accessibility and also education and resources around the use of medical cannabis responsibly. Not everybody is going to be a smoker. Not anyone, everyone's going to appeal to edibles. And so there's a lot of modes of delivery, and the therapeutic action of cannabis is quite large, and figuring out mode of delivery and dosage and all that is really individual and particular to folks. And so I've always had a hand in this. And so I'm kind of like the picture perfect person to like be your local cannabis farmer in Sonoma County. And I will just say it's a climate of that there are very few of us cultivators actually remaining. When they excluded what's known as rural residential and ag residential zones, which is where the majority of us were cultivating prior to 2017, they pretty much wiped out like 90% of the population. And so of that population, there was a small handful, like a few handfuls of us that decided to, we were displaced, and we decided on our own accord to go find eligible places. And of those folks that found eligible places and got a permit, most of those are now gone. And I'm one of the few remaining what you would consider mom and pop growers. And what remains in Sonoma County are a couple of bigger entities. And when I say a bigger entity, I'm talking about an acre, which I know in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't seem like a lot. But I pride myself on being owner-operated. And what does that mean? It means that the herb that's presented to the public, I actually grew. And that means something to me. Because now in an era where most growers at the turn of the corner became CEOs and had employees, I decided that there was still a lot of value in actually contributing my touch to the plant. And you know, I know that there's a lot of interesting things that go along with that, but that's been one of my commitments to, you know, having a hand in this.
That's really exciting, because I know a lot of people who are CEOs of cultivation companies at this point, and they rarely touch the plant. So the idea that your hands are still on the plant is really a beautiful thing.
Yeah, I've actually resisted scaling up. Initially, I had a lot of offers to, you know, a lot of folks wanted to see me grow and invest and expand. And I really, really, really resisted that, just because prior to legalization of commercial cannabis, I was involved in different projects that I could feel when they would get a bit overwhelming, and I felt what it felt like to be on a hamster wheel. And I actually just got real clear with myself on what I wanted to be doing in my life, which was not managing a whole lot of people. Now, I still work with folks. Like I bring in, I've sort of escaped having to have quote unquote employees, but I basically contract with a team to where it's not a cannabis team. It's basically a crew of landscape contractors. A buddy of mine is a landscape contractor. And so he lends me his team when I have big work pushes. Mm-hmm. So that's like a few times a year, you know, that's during planting and trim down and harvest. I bring in helping hands, but on the day-to-day, I'm the one who makes the decisions, and I'm the one there with my plants. I start my seeds, I transplant my babies, and I see them through.
Excellent, excellent, excellent. So what are, I know that in your policy work, or in the dealings with you're having with Sonoma County, you're in the process of, you have a letter writing campaign that's attached to your public hearing that's coming up?
Yeah, so I have a public hearing. Right now it's scheduled for December 14th. And like I was mentioning, the local community has been very vocal against my project from day one. And so we're going on 6 years. And I really need, or I would like to show the other side of the spectrum, which is the overwhelming amount of support and gratitude and appreciation for a product such as mine. And I am gonna, I have a letter, and I'd like folks to have accessibility to that, to show their support and be able to personalize it. So that I think the easiest way is on my Instagram, which is Agricola Flower. That's A-G-R-I-C-O-L-A and the word flower. And I'll have a link in the bio where folks can sign that.
Excellent. So folks who hear this before this happens, definitely go check out our IG page and sign that. And even if it's after that date, check out our IG page just to see the amazing products that you guys produce up there.
Yes.
I know we're going to wrap up here in a minute, but I am curious, now that you've been had your medical practice for years, how has that impacted your growing and what you produce or how you approach cannabis?
Okay, so I still see some of the same things that I saw when I was fresh out of school, but the value now that I see in land-based activities is even greater. Like more and more, I'm opening up my farm to be an educational space and resource, especially for historically disenfranchised folks, that land accessibility has been a challenge. And what I mean by that is like simple things like planting trees and helping to create and sustain biodiversity. Like I'm creating more of an educational platform, because I actually think that this is like the key to a lot of us achieving the freedom that we desire, is being able to know how to support ourselves with food and being able to work the land. And so it's through this process of me being involved in the politics of cannabis, I'm reminded constantly of how it's just a symbol of something greater, and on basically the landscape of us continuing to push forward for true accessibility and true access to the things that help make us well and alive and connected to one another and the earth.
That's beautiful. Could ask you a bunch more questions. We're running out of time here today. We definitely like to get together in the future and actually go visit your farm and kind of show some of the work you're doing up there, if that's ever convenient and safe. And we can do that in the future. And then today when we leave here, we're going to go over to Equity Trade and show some of the amazing flowers that you've brought down with us and buy in a little bit of that. But anything you want to say before we wrap it up?
Okay. I just want to say that when you asked me about how it's been up north, I just want to say that finding the Equity Trade Network has been an invaluable resource. I felt a bit lost and I was having trouble finding my right fit with distribution and representation. And when I found Ramon and Nina, they've been just a godsend. And just like the community that you and I, Taryn, are part of, has just been like instrumental and helping me continue feel like I do this for a reason, and I'm so grateful.
Yeah, no, I'm grateful for the Equity Trade Network too, but I'm also really grateful for you, because it's easy to be down here in the Bay Area working in cannabis and kind of forgetting that there's people up and down the state doing this. And when we think about up north, it's usually a very white image of what we have that's happening up north. It's just white folks on the hill kind of a thing. And it's beautiful to know that there's other folks up there that have been doing it for so many years and doing it well and doing it with responsibility and intent. So that's I was excited to meet you, and I always get a little intimidated because you're super serious, you're super busy, and like you're handling shit so much, you're not just sitting around smoking. But it's an honor to know you, and I love working with you, and I've worked with your flower before. We look forward to working with your flower again in the future, and we look forward to enjoying some of your flower in the next hour. And but thank you so much for taking the time to be down here, and it was a pleasure as always.
Thank you, Taryn.
Thank you.